welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back to the top of a new week and a fresh episode. This week, I would like to continue our conversation about how to build organizational resilience. Now, there's two phases to this. There's always that about leaders leading themselves and entrepreneurs leading themselves through difficult times and challenges. But then there's the bigger question about how to formulate resilient teams, divisions, departments, and organizations and companies. And so I have a great guest who can add to that picture. His name is Paul Henriksen. You know, for more than 20 years, he's worked with the Norwegian military and the police force. And in those years, he's experienced firsthand what threats people and businesses are subject to. Now, Paul has learned how to build resilience, both at a personal and organizational level. And this has been through his own military training, police training, his work experience, and interaction with people who have been subject to different traumas. Whether it's been in theaters of conflict, such as Kosovo and Afghanistan, or it's been in the streets of Norway. Currently, Paul holds the position of COO at Einung Safety Consult. It's a consultancy company that specializes in fire safety, HSE, which is health safety environments, readiness, and leadership. Now, his company specializes in making risk, consequence, and vulnerability analysis for both private and public businesses. And this includes fire departments and municipalities. I mean, I wanted to bring Paul in because I think he has a very special and unique perspective on how to deal with risks and vulnerabilities. And these are key things to address to mitigate these risks and vulnerabilities and to build organizational resilience. You know, because of his military experience, because of his police experience and corporate experience, And considering, you know, we have this war raging on the borders of Europe, we've just come out of a pandemic 10, 12 months ago, you know, we have logistics problems, energy crisis, blah, 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 all of this coming at us. So there's a lot of moving parts. And so sometimes we need to look outside the organization for a professional perspective that can help us mitigate risks in our day to day. So without further ado, let's slip into the stream and meet Paul Henriksen. Thank you for joining us today, Paul. I think your background, who you are, and what you contribute and where you are today has a lot to contribute to the picture of resilience and how we face adversity. Maybe we could start for our audience to tell us who you are and maybe a little bit of your background.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here. Well, my name is Paul Henriksen. I'm 46 years of age. I'm a CEO of a consultant company. We do courses, risk analysis within HSE, fire safety, readiness or preparedness, and leadership.
And HSE, just to clarify, that's health, safety, environment, those focuses.
Environment, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've not been doing that for a long time, but I've been in the company for several years. I quit a career in the police on October 1st. I became the CEO of this company. I worked here on the side for the last 6 years since we started up in 2017. But I've been, most of my adult life as a military police or police officer in the military and the Norwegian police force.
And that's what I think I found very sort of intriguing about your background. You know, you were the head of investigation in Ullensvang. It's I guess it's a municipality within Norway. Yeah. But you also have a long history with the military police, and you've not only been here in Norway, but you've served abroad. I was wondering maybe you could tell us a little about maybe your military background and how that has contributed to who you are today. You know, the man who has to face, you know, adversity, who has to face different types of situations that you do as a military police officer and as a head of investigation before this current job?
Well, let's start with the beginning. In 1998, you know, in Norway, we have conscripts. Every man, now also every woman, or most, actually just half. But back in the days, all men had to do a certain period of time, serve in the military. I was in the Navy for 12 months. I was recommended to become a military policeman because that was a very interesting, independent sort of duty. So I became a military police soldier, and that was very interesting. What's up in the north in Tromsø in the conscript time. And then I went back to the civilian life for a couple of months. And then a colleague of mine, or a fellow soldier up in Tromsø, where I used to serve in the conscript time, he sent me an email and called me and said that there was a job opportunity as an international military policeman in the Netherlands. Back then, it was the headquarters of Northern Europe for NATO. So I applied and I got the job, and I was there for 5 years. Was stationed in the Netherlands, but then I was, we were sent to once to Kosovo, twice to Afghanistan on peacekeeping missions. It was 5 years really full of experiences, from kind of boring night shifts in the Netherlands on weekdays where nothing happened, to most extreme situation was rocket attacks we had down in Afghanistan, you know, where everyone ran to the bunkers and the sirens sounded. It was 5 really interesting years. And because of those years, I kind of fell in love with policing, or investigations, really. Analysis, like we do a lot of now, to use the brain to research, to find out what happened, to be detective, you know, how should we do this? Why did this happen? How can we prevent this? That's basically what policing is about, to prevent. And then when something has happened, you go in and see that it doesn't happen again, and that the perpetrators are caught, of course. So I moved back to Norway in 2005, and after less than a year, I got a job as a policeman. Back then, you didn't need education to become a policeman. You need it if you wanted a permanent job. But especially on the countryside, where they had big problems recruiting police personnel, they would use people without police education. In Norway, you need a 3-year education to become a policeman or policewoman.
You need a bachelor's degree, I think.
Bachelor's
degree. Yeah.
The police university college. But back then, I got a job on the countryside in Sogn og Fjordane as a police constable. I stayed there for a year. But the chief of police always said that, you know, Paul, if you want to become a policeman permanently, you need to take the police university college. And of course, that was logic. And I wanted to work as a policeman. So, of course, I applied. They accepted me. I took the police education in 2010. I graduated. And since then, I worked in Odda in Ullsvang municipality. In 2018, I became head of investigation section, and I held that job till I quit now on October 1st.
And you have a long and varied history, and you know it's quite intriguing. It's quite fascinating to see how it shaped a man such as yourself, going from somewhere quite, I guess, quite peaceful like the Netherlands, down to Kosovo, down to Afghanistan. So if we could hit the pause button, rewind on your life back to, let's say, Kosovo and Afghanistan. You know, as we talked about when I invited you to the show, the major focus is to share stories, skills, and strategies how to build resilience. And having professionals such as you who can talk from raw experience and not just textbook, I think is so key to adding to this picture. And it's how we face adversity, but it's also how to create a sense of well-being, even in the chaos. So I was wondering, is there, if we could rewind back to your early days as an MP, military police, was there one or two stories that you can share with us that really shaped who you are, made you a stronger man, even though maybe at first it hit you hard, but you've learned to grow from that experience?
Well, we had a lot of experiences. I think that the most extreme was in Kabul, you know, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. We were always on the alert. And from time to time, they would shoot or attack NATO forces. Mm-hmm. Twice, they shot rockets against our camp. Everyone went into the bunkers. I remember the first time they shot rockets at us. I was standing outside the building where I worked. It was late in the evening, and it was in the summer. It wasn't, I think, around 20th of June. It was warm, pleasant. You work 12-hour shifts from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock in the evening. Mm-hmm. So just standing there and breathe is great. So I was standing there relaxing, and all of a sudden I hear this sound above my head, like if you imagine the sound of a New Year's rocket.
Yeah, the whistles, right?
Yeah, yes, whistles, thank you. Like sparks coming out of it. And I looked up, it was a lot heavier sound, but it was related to that of a New Year rocket. So I looked up, I didn't see any sparks, and I was like, what is this? And a couple of seconds later, I heard the boom, you know, a couple of hundred meters away. And when you work in the military, the first thing they teach you is the ground training. And then before they send you to these broad peacekeeping missions, they teach you how your body reacts to traumas or to extreme happening situations. And everyone in our psychology know the fight, flight, freeze. You know, you either fight or you flight or you run away.
The F3 response, yes.
Yes. And I froze. I heard the boom and I was like, I was just standing there, dead still. Just like when the sound came, it just stopped. I never heard that sound before. They taught us about, you know, bombs and mines and what you should look out for. And don't walk on the red side of the rock, walk on the white side because that's safe, you know. But I never heard the sound. So I froze. And then I don't know if it was 5 seconds or 30 seconds later, this American colleague of mine came running. Incoming! Incoming! And I remember I started laughing because he was running in a really funny way. I thought it was funny anyway. And it was, you know, And then snap, I got out of it. I ran over to the MP station. You know, everyone went to the bunkers. We didn't go to the bunkers. The military police, the staff and the headquarters support group and the guard soldiers, they went to their posts, manned their posts. So I went in there, you know, we got on our flak jacket, a bulletproof vest, 20 kilos, machine pistol, radio, torch, helmet, of course. And we stood in line and waited to get a task because our job was basically to see to that everyone had gone to the bunkers. So we did. And everything that happened was, you know, after I woke up, after I froze and you know, snapped out of it, everything was according to plan because we had exercise, we had rehearsed, we had an exercise a couple of weeks before where we rehearsed everything. Things didn't work out well. It turned out that several routines were not good enough. Mm-hmm. But when it really happened, when the rocket attack came, everything worked. So exercise is great. When people talk about organizational resilience, exercise, exercise, exercise. Because the day things happen, it's too late to find out.
It has to be almost automated. It has to be almost habitual, your response.
Exactly.
Because I've seen that with a lot of people, you know, all of a sudden, what like you did, you kind of choked. There was inaction, indecision. You were kind of just frozen in the moment. But that's why I think we can call it that muscle memory or the training or the habitual response to crisis is so important in training and in resilience, because then your body just takes over. You don't have to think, because thinking is going to actually trip you up sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Because stress, as we also learned from the crisis psychology team and military defense forces, they had lessons with us and taught us about this before we went to peacekeeping missions. Mandatory for all personnel who goes out is a great, great thing that they do this. When you, the first time you experience it and you haven't experienced it before, you freeze. If you start thinking, it won't work. Because as you know, stress will kind of cut off the logic thinking. That's what you know, there's more about this than I do. But that's the basic rule.
Yes, totally. It shrinks your mental acuity, your ability to process information just shrinks down to almost a tunnel, a very tight tunnel vision, right? Because you're only looking for the threat or the hazard. You're so problem focused.
Mm-hmm. So your senses, your hearing, everything becomes better, but logic thinking cuts off. That's why you have to know what you're doing. And then you do it. And that thing worked that first time for me, because once I snapped out of it, I did everything according to plan. Everyone else did too. I think they did a great job. The second time we had a rocket attack. At once, when the boom came, I was running and I managed to think, because I'd experienced it before. So I had mental capacity to handle the impressions, you know?
Yeah, because you had the experience, you could draw from that experience to understand, because the mind is a prediction machine. It's trying to constantly read the world, or at least the brain is a prediction machine. But that previous rocket attack allowed you to have some sort of map as to what happens and how it plays out. Is that what I understand?
Yes. It had a reference to what happened. It's like if you got a new Xerox machine or copying machine at work, the first time you will stand there for 3 minutes because you got to scan a document, you know, it's like, what should I, and then all those words that we can't repeat on live, you know, but then 2 months later, you can scan dozens of documents at the same time. You can talk to people and drink coffee and do everything at the same time because it's automated. You don't have to think about it. You can do many other things while operating the Xerox machine. And it's the same thing. When it comes to a crisis, you need that automated way of handling things, way of acting.
I think the term I've heard is like unconscious competence. You're just competent unconsciously and it just happens, right? And that's what the training does. That's what the psychologists tell you. In the first rocket attack, what did you learn about yourself when you kind of debriefed with yourself and you kind of reflected that evening, you're sleeping in bed, you're safe at that point, but the chaos of that day, what did you reflect on? What was the most salient or most important thing that came to your mind?
That I froze. I was 28 years old. I've been to Kosovo. I've been to Afghanistan for a couple of weeks or a month.
Sure.
We'd never been under attack like that. We trained for it, but I never actually lived through it. You watched movies, you had training, you shoot rockets and you shoot with blanks and everything and sharp ammo as well. So you know the sounds, you know everything. But then and there, I froze. And that was like, what do you call an epiphany? Or like... Yes. It was a big experience, but I wasn't like a lot of people. If you don't know about the fight, flight, freeze, you might think that, oh, gee, I did wrong. I froze. I'm a cool soldier. I got a gun. I should be tough like, you know, Sylvester Stallone and He-Man and everyone. But you're not. But I wasn't mad at myself. I didn't think less of myself, even though I froze, because I knew that's a natural reaction. But the next time when the rocket came, I remember this very clearly, because I was sitting in the distilled garden. It was a little area with benches and small tables. People sat there and drank cappuccino, coffee, beer. And there was a large boom. And then a split second later, a very loud howling sound. That's when it came through the air. And then boom, when it collided with a building and exploded. And snapped. I didn't freeze. My head just went in, you know, mode.
Yeah, yeah. Into the automatic mode there to respond.
Because I knew I got to get to the MP station. So I started running. And everyone was running out in to this little road that led me to the MP station. Mm-hmm. I actually turned and went into an area where they played a lot of loud music, the welfare tent. I walked in there. People were sitting there drinking beer, having a cup of coffee, because they hadn't heard the explosion because the music was so loud. It was really loud.
Wow.
They had a disco in there. They showed football matches and big screen, the whole
great
tent.
Okay.
Time. This day, it was just the music. But the bartender, he must have had reduced hearing. But I went over to the bar and like, hey, you. Mm. And he's like, what is it? You know, everyone hates the MP, so he was not. I don't know. And I'm like, turn on the music. And he turned on the music. And I shouted, rocket attack, rocket attack. Everyone out that way. And I pointed to the door in the opposite end. And everyone started running. And if I had not experienced that first rocket attack a month earlier, I would never had the mental capacity to handle a situation like I did.
Now, in the second part of our conversation, Paul talks about and emphasizes the importance of resilience and looking at three perspectives: before, sort of preparedness, during, how we act during the situation, and after. After being the debrief, how did we learn? What did we learn from how we responded to the crisis situation or to the challenge? Now, Paul draws from his experience and his history as a detective working on the Norwegian police force when it comes to responding to a car crash, a homicide, or some other event. Showing up as a detective or as a constable to that situation, he knows there will be other first responders there, paramedics and other police officers. And knowing that there are other professionals on site means he is not responding alone. And knowing that there is a support network, that there are other professionals like himself on the ground with him, well, that helps to deal with what can be a horrific situation. Also, that his role is well defined. He has to control the situation. He needs to understand the situation. And thus, his training and his background to crisis response allows him to know what to do. There's not a lot of room to second guess himself. He knows specifically what to do. And it's that training that he teaches to others, but which is so key to building organizational resilience. Well, I'll let Paul speak more to this. That first rocket attack, you know, when you sat there, you weren't kind of berating yourself or punishing yourself for not being the soldier, you know, and getting your gun ready and charging into battle kind of thing. You kind of reflect, and I think that's a very important characteristic of resilience, is the ability to have a flexible mindset to learn and to adapt and not have this fixed definition of whatever we have in our picture, a picture in our head, and then living to that. Because sometimes we won't live up to that fantasy picture we have of ourselves, and reality kicks in, and Murphy throws his whatever two cents in, and we trip up and we have to learn. And I think what you're saying, as easy as that sounds for a lot of people get so fixed up and wrapped up in their narrative Your narrative was one which was much more healthy in the sense, okay, how do I learn from this? What do I do? This is what I've learned. I've choked up. I froze up. But how do I move on with this to make it better the next time? At least that's what I understand you're saying.
Yes. And that's only because these psychologists and experts from the, I believe it's called the crisis psychology team.
Had
this lesson with us. I think it was almost a whole day. You know, before they send you to peacekeeping mission, they send you to this course, so this 1 week stay. It was outside Oslo somewhere, the capital city of Norway. And we had this round with rockets and landmines, you know, mine awareness, aid, a little geography, like what, where is it, about the people, religion, culture, what to say, what not to do, what to do, and so on. And also, of course, about handling stress. And, you know, you hear a lot about people who went to Lebanon and other places for the UN, for with the Norwegian military, and they came back traumatized, also from Afghanistan, other places. I believe the military has become a lot better. At least my experience was that they handle us very well. So also, and that's the point. I believe that resilience, both personal and organizational resilience, is built by, you know, before, during, and after. I mentioned it before. Now, during you build a happening, an incident, you build resilience by doing what you're taught to do. That's it. You can't do anything else. And if you stress, of course, like if being a policeman for many years, we had a lot of like big accidents and other happening incidents we responded to where there's an overload. There's too much information, too much happening. You just got to step down and say, my head cannot handle all this. I do not have all that mental capacity. So you have to preserve your mental capacity and say that to yourself. If you can handle it, then tell somebody else who is there with you and do less. Because else you get, you know, what's it called? You get a shortcut. It's like the fuse when it, there's too much electricity. There's too much.
Yeah, it shorts out, right? It shorts out. And then because we can only take in so much, we can only process so much. And, you know, one thing is every day there's noise, there's traffic, whatever, dogs barking. But what you're talking are extreme situations, whether it's a car accident with all the medical response of first responders, or it's an active shooter or whatever it might be. There's a lot to process, especially when you're walking into a life-death situation. Or you see the carnage after a terrible car accident or something. I mean, for the brain to process that, that's a lot. And especially if you've never experienced something like that, it's almost like, as you said, the first time you guys got shelled in Afghanistan and Kabul, it could be that choke response because it's just too much to process, and the central nervous system doesn't shut down, but it kind of overloads, as you said.
And that's why you need to build resilience before. You can only measure resilience after an incident, but you build resilience before and during.
Well said. Well said. One of the things you also made a very important point where you said, you know, when I learned from the crisis management team or the crisis psychology team, how the brain reacts, how the brain works and such. I think that's very important because that's something I try for my own sort of practice or my own business is try to instill in working professionals. And we'll come back to Einon Consulting in a sec. But I think that is very important because once you can teach someone that this is the brain and how it works, you know, like the heart pumps blood, the lung pumps oxygen. Well, the brain, it pumps survival. And when it's in a crisis situation or a perceived crisis situation, doesn't even have to be a real one. It could be something that's floating in our head. Our brains will go this way. And so it's not an indication that we are weak or that we are or negative or what have you. No, this is how the brain works. And I think by those psychologists and psychiatrists teaching men and women such as yourselves in the field how the brain works, that almost empowers you because then it gives you a chance to reflect, okay, there goes my brain. It's going to survival mode. and then you can pull back from that. Is that what I understand you've been communicating?
Yes, correct. It's like a lot of people who have anxiety and fears, mm-hmm. a lot of them, the thing they're most afraid of is, you know, getting a panic attack or being mm-hmm. anxious. It's not the thing they're afraid of. What are they really afraid of? Well, a lot of times they can't explain. But if they knew mm-hmm. how the mind works and that, you know, it's natural for all people to feel anxious from time to time, especially periods of the life where you feel anxiety, there's a lot of stress. You know, the two things that are most stressing for a human being, I'm not a psychologist, but this I read, is divorcing, you know, splitting up from your life partner and moving to another location. That's the two most stressing life events mm-hmm. for a human being, well, at least two of them. Let's say you move yeah. to a new place. When you get in the bathroom in the morning, you don't have to think like, where, how do I put the light on in here? Mm-hmm. Are there handkerchiefs? Are there like towels somewhere? You know, everything has to be.
You actually know where the bathroom is, right?
Yes. You got to search for it. When you wake up in the morning, you don't have to think about mm-hmm. where the towels are, how to turn on the water, how do you get cold, how do you get hot water. But all these things have to be processed by your brain. Once they're processed and automated, your mind knows how to do it. Mm-hmm. So,
I think that's an important point, because what I hear you saying is that, you know, it's through experience, it's actually through going through a ritual or going through some learning something that your brain maps something. And when it creates a map of whatever, brushing your teeth or where the bathroom is or how to make coffee or whatever it is, there's a level of control, a level of certainty, and there's a predictable outcome. And mm-hmm. I think those are the three factors that allow us to become resilient. But resilient, as you said, can only be measured after the fact. It's with hindsight. It's during the moment that we see how our training kicks in or how the lessons we've learned get applied. And I think what you're saying is sort of the training before or the practice of before. So if we take a moment, if we fast forward to your previous job as a head of investigation, how has that contributed to your individual resilience? I mean, what have you learned about yourself as, you know, a head detective, a head of investigation for those years?
Well, you learned that when people experience something extreme, like if it's a car accident where mm. people crunched in the car, or you see a dead body, or a dead body has been laying for a long time, or whatever it is, you know, threatening situations, people come towards you and they want to take your life away, at least they say so. Violent situations, you know, situations where there's a lot of people and where they're very hostile. The thing is that when you have a role, when you're there in your uniform, or maybe you're in civilian, but you're there because you're at work, mm-hmm. You kind of distance yourself from the situation. Firefighters, ambulance personnel, and police distance themselves, also soldiers, from the situation.
Can you explain? Can you elaborate a little on that? What exactly? I think I know what you mean. But what do you mean? How these first responders distance themselves from the actual situation if they're in the here and now? Can you sort of just clarify that?
Yeah, I'm not there as Paul Henriksen. I'm not there as, hey, I'm here and I was just walking by and I saw this thing happening. That would be kind of extreme if you saw a car accident, came to a scene of a car accident and somebody were crunched inside the car. Mm. But when you come there as a police or an ambulance or a worker or a firefighter, you're there. First of all, you know up front that you're going to an incident. Mm. You know that you're not alone. Normally you have a partner with you and you have the other emergency services. You know that it's your job to control the situation. So you're in control of the situation. You decide what happens. You have experienced it before. So you know basically how this is going to be. You get a lot of messages on your ear, on your radio, on your way to the scene. Yeah, there are two cars here. The fire department has already arrived. And you get all this information on your way to the scene. And you know that after this, you don't go home and sit there, you know, drink a glass of water and act real nervous. You know that these things are handled afterwards with your colleagues, with your boss. You got a colleague support in the police. Fire departments have it, a lot of them. I don't know if the ambulance service do, but that's one colleague you can talk to, and on you know, without it going further. If you had some impressions, or you can talk freely to that person about impressions and feelings, emotions. It's like a security, you know, an insurance. So if people have experienced something extreme, they can go to the colleague support or their boss or any other colleague or a psychologist or the doctor and talk about it as a professional person, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference when it's like you have a shield around you that shields you from everything. When we go out patrolling, we have a bulletproof vest that also has aluminium plates. So if people try to stab you or shoot you, they're not very lucky with it. At least
no.
Vest, you know.
Thankful for that. Yeah, definitely.
Yep, and you got a gun. You go, oh, at least now temporarily the Norwegian police is armed. Sorry, I'm talking August 2022 now, but I believe they will be the new year.
Mm. Well, this is, you know, what you're saying is almost what I talked to a war correspondent, a war photographer, and he said when he looks through the camera, it gives him an objective. Even though the chaos and the carnage is happening there just on the other side of his lens, he has that objective distance because he is there as a witness, as a bystander to record the events for the news, for history, for the greater world, to get the message out there. And that in itself is his mental shielding. This helps him to face adversity and to deal with, to build up that resilience or that thicker skin. And what I hear you saying, Paul, is that when you go there, you have a job. You show up as the detective, you know, whatever it is, taping off the area. You're going there to gain some control and overwatch, oversight over the idea. And is this what you're saying when you say I go in there with a little distance? It gives you an objectivity. And it also sounds like, well, you have a role, as the fire people do, as the ambulance, as the paramedics, as the cops. They go in with a certain role, but you have this support network to kind of deal with the situation. Is that the distancing you speak of then, I understand it?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Like, you have your vest to protect you against bullets and knives, people hitting you.
Physical threats, yeah.
Yep. And you also have a mental barrier shield. You built resilience, you have the training, you know what to do then and there. You got the people on the air, you can call on your ear, on your head, earpiece, you know, on the radio. You can contact colleagues or the operational central, what is called Joint Operations Center, for backup information. You also know that there's a follow-up afterwards. So you got both a physical and a mental shield against anyone who wants to harm you. You're not there as Paul or John or whatever your name is. You're not there as a private individual and have to deal with stuff yourself later.
Now, I think that's very important, because basically what you're talking about is that you put on a frame. You have a frame going in, and that kind of shields you from, well, let's call it the trauma or the horror that you might have to what you're walking into as an MP or as a police officer, as a, you know, head of investigation. I mean, these are not light things that you walk into. No. As if we pull out now as a civilian, but I just want to focus on you, Paul, as an individual. You have this 20, 25 years of experience in some most hairiest place on the earth, dealing with criminals, dealing with car accidents, dealing with crime, what have you. What skills do you take from that experience to help you build resilience as a civilian out there in your day to day?
Good question. Complex question. Just want to add one thing.
Please.
Because part of the answer. I just said before that you build resilience before enduring incidents. You also build it afterwards. You have something called defusing and debriefing processes you go through after a happening. Defusing is as soon as possible afterwards, where you talk about, you know, what happened, who did what, why did they do it, to get the puzzle together. Because when you're part of a puzzle, when you're part of an operation or happening incident, you know what you do, you know what you can see and hear. You don't know the whole picture. So you get that by doing a defusing. And afterwards, before 2 days, you do have a debriefing with the other people who responded to the incident. And still we're talking police, you know, military, ambulance, emergencies. You have a debriefing where you go through and talk about what you felt, what, you know, what were the
process, the emotions and the thinking, and to put it into as a piece of the bigger puzzle, as you said.
Yeah. And then after that, of course, you might take part in an evaluation. If it's a really large happening, like for us, helicopter crashes, we have some of those from time to time, unfortunately. Homicide attempts, child abuse, you evaluate and you go through and then you see what did we do well, what did we do not so well, how should we do it the next time, where can we get support, where can we, you know, how can we become better at what we do. That's also a security, even though you feel like you don't perform 100% then and there when things happen. You know that, well, if I do something wrong now, I'm going to become better the next time. And so are my colleagues. That also builds resilience. So you build resilience before, during, and after. And as a consultant company, you know, we offer a variety of courses within HSE, fire safety, readiness, and leadership. To private and public businesses. We also have consultant services. We make like fire safety documentation. We're really good at risk analysis. It's called risk and vulnerability analysis. It's an analysis of businesses where you define what risks are there, how can you reduce the risk of unwanted incidents happening, and what can you do to reduce the consequences if it still happens?
Yeah, because this is almost, I guess this is the before resilience. You're kind of mapping the vulnerabilities and risks of that organization, of that team, of what have you.
You build organizational resilience, and making a risk analysis is like you go through before, during, and after. What can you do to prevent it? What can you do to reduce the consequences when it happens? And what can you do to reduce the long-term consequences? When you assess the vulnerability the business has, if an unwanted incident occurs, you also start looking at, you know, the long-term, the strategic picture.
You know, because I'd like to explore that with you in more depth. Back to the man, the individual, you know, you also work with this. And when you're talking about before and during and after, like for yourself, when you go through an incident now, whatever that is, a small car accident, some sort of altercation of words or what have you. But I want to look at the man behind the corporation. How do you process information right now? How do you process events and situations that have happened to you?
It's really important that you don't leave it once something has happened, that you don't do something else to forget about it. You have to dive in. You know, being a policeman is actually a perfect way to deal with incidents, because you go out there, you handle the situation, then you go back to your office, and then you sit down and write a report about it. So you actually write down everything that happened. Because when you file a report on like a car crash, or if you find a dead body that's been laying for a long time, you have to do all these things right away. You don't have time to think, really, because there are so many things you have to do. So you sit down, you write a report on this and this day, this and this day. I was on duty together with police officer, blah, blah, blah. We drove a uniform car, call signal was this and that. At this hours, we got a message from this and that person that this had happened. And you write everything in detail. And that's like therapy, you know?
It's totally.
If you have a family, two adults and three children that went to a tragic traffic accident, and you find them at the hospital and want to talk to them about what happened, the best thing for them to, how do you say, to cope with the situation and to move on is to talk with each other. Do a defusing and then do a debriefing, basically. But you don't call that when it's not professional. But that's what they do, talking to each other. What happened? Why did that happen? How do you feel about it? You know, that's the best therapy there is. And as a policeman or policewoman, you sit down and you write everything that happened. So you sort your thoughts.
It's amazing the process that you guys have to go through, because, I mean, you have to do all this. This is part of what is expected of you as a professional. And it's there's a lot of parallels to what I see that I do with clients. You know, most of them are sort of corporate clients, you know, professionals and such. But it's something we've talked about time and time again on this podcast is expressive writing. You know, and basically it's just that, as you said, it's to process what is going on. That is part of your job. And so that's automatic. But a lot of people don't know how to process, because if we don't process emotions and thoughts, as you so clearly articulated, what happens is that it gets stuck in our central nervous system. It shows up as insomnia, as skin rashes, as losing hair, as stiff shoulders or migraines. And this is what it gets trapped. And this is what sometimes leads to, unfortunately, post-traumatic stress disorder, because these men and women, whatever it is, they don't have to be soldiers. It could be domestic abuse. They don't have the chance to process or to talk. And so what you're saying is so salient. It's so on topic here. Now, before we move into the third part of the conversation, I just wanted to rewind what Paul said there. Now, he was talking about the process of diffusing and debriefing after a situation. It doesn't always have to be some sort of crisis or storm. It could have just been something that has happened to us, and we need to process those emotions and those thoughts. Like those police officers, they have to write a report. Yes, it is to document what happened, but it also serves a second and very important purpose, if not a primary purpose, is to help that officer, to help that professional deal with what has happened, to deal with their thoughts, to articulate their thinking and their emotions on paper, allowing them to process the event and allowing them to move on. And I want to emphasize how important expressive writing is. You can call it journaling, you could call it report writing, you could call it whatever you want. But what Paul talked about, that diffusing and debriefing response, is so important. Now, in the last part of our conversation, Paul talks about iKnown Consultancy and what they do, how they map out dangers and vulnerabilities for organizations, for small companies, big companies, municipalities, fire departments, what have you. If you're a group of people working under the same umbrella, well, iKnown are the people to call, because they map out those dangers and unwanted incidents, and hopefully they never happen. But if you have a strategy and plan, well, that could actually save life and limb. Well, I'll let Paul elaborate more on that. All right, Paul, take it away.
We have, well, me with my background in education within risk analysis, leadership, readiness management, police management. Mm-hmm. I've taken a lot of extra education after police university college. Kareen iKnown, who founded iKnown Safety, she has a bachelor in what's it called, risk. Yeah, it's like it's 2 years of leadership and organization and leadership, and then it's one extra with risk analysis and so on. And she's also a fire engineer. It's also a bachelor, and she's an HSE engineer, which is a third bachelor. She started in the fire department many years ago. I believe it was in 2000 or 2001, worked her way up, and she was a fire chief for the last 5 years.
She's got a lot of broad experience, not just education, but a lot of experience.
Yeah. And, you know, the municipality is so big that we got several fire stations, and I believe there are around 80 firefighters in the fire department, all in all. She has a very wide experience. And that's why when we don't just make risk analysis for one type of companies, more. We've done a lot for fire departments, also for municipalities. We've assisted several municipalities making their like overall risk and vulnerability analysis. Every municipality has to have one. And then each sector, each service has to have their own.
Yes.
Analysis. We also made for smaller companies, bigger companies. A risk analysis or risk and vulnerability analysis, RUS-analyse in Norwegian, short, builds resilience because, and that's why we love the concept. And also, it's mandatory. The law says that every business should identify the risks, dangers in their business, and that they should find measures and make plans to reduce risk. So it's mandatory. So it's great. We don't sell something people don't need. It's actually, the law says they have to have it. But a lot of people in business, they don't know how to make a risk analysis. And that's where we come in and assist them. And what you see is that when a company sits down and really takes this serious, first of all, they find out, they identify the threats, the risks, the hazards in the business. And then they find out, well, how likely is it that these incidents happen and what consequences can there be? So they can range the different incidents, unwanted incidents, we call them, towards each other, which is more serious, which is less serious. Because that's how you assess risk in a company.
Well, you're almost like those psychologists when you were in Afghanistan. They kind of taught you and they identify potential risks and potential things that could happen. And then you know, because that gives you a sense of confidence of how to react if the unmentionable does happen at some point. Hopefully it never does, but I think you're almost like that crisis team, or your Einon consultancy is almost like that when it comes to companies, because as you said, you map out the dangers, the hazards and the vulnerabilities and the risks. And then all of a sudden here's your plan B if things go sideways on you. And so that builds a sense of confidence of how we can professionally relate to a crisis, because coming out of this pandemic, you know, I'm glad we are far out of the pandemic, but you know, a lot of most companies had to scramble. And I think it's top of mind to think about resilience and things that can happen, because we never thought a pandemic can happen, but bang, 24 months into it, there it was. So I think your services are so important at the moment, or anytime actually.
Always, because everything can happen and things do happen. You have to be prepared for what is going to happen. And when you sit down and you identify the threats, the dangers, the unwanted incidents, and you assess them and you find measures to prevent them and measures to reduce consequences should they still happen, then you build organizational resilience. And when you involve the employees in that company and the leaders in that company, they sit down and they understand that, okay, this company cares. They know what can happen. They're prepared. Things doesn't just happen. You know, there's a plan.
Yeah.
And that's, I wanted to add that, you know, the law says that you shall identify risks in the company. Like if you have a business with 100 people, industry, you know, they produce stuff, they produce boats. What can happen? Well, obviously it's located by the water, so people can fall in the water. Get them up again. You have maybe some explosive gases. You can have fire hazards. If you got lithium batteries on those boats, they can start burning. If it's a big battery, this is a 300 meter security zone you have to have around it, according to you, not regulation, but advice.
Well, a lot of people like ourselves, like civilians, would not know this. And I think that's why professionals like you coming in, just like in Afghanistan, you had those psychologists that taught you, or those experts that taught you about, you know, explosions and grenades and how to respond. That, as you said, something could happen. As you talked about in your story, you choked, or you kind of froze on the spot, but then muscle memory kicked in, habit kicked in. And I think that's what your company, in a sense, does. People might choke up, but if there's something in place, just execute. You don't have to think. Just execute on how to manage this crisis. Is that what I understand?
Yep. And that's what we do. The risk analysis and to implement measures, plans to reduce risk is mandatory. Also, we take it one step further. Make preparedness plans or readiness plans. Like it's basically a document, or it's on the computer today, you know, that says how the organization works, who has the authority to order this and that, and who decides what. And then it's basically lists what do you do if this happens. Like you have a certain incident. Just go to, you look in the what's it called?
Checklist or a crisis response list?
You go on the list of contents, you go like, oh, that's not happening. Okay, you go to page 3, and then you say, there's a list of what you should do. Call this person, alert that person, do this, do that, and so on. So you don't have to think. You've done the analysis. First, you analyze what can happen. How likely is it? What consequences can it have? What measures can we implement to reduce the likelihood and the consequences should it still happen? And then you analyze, well, what do we need to reduce the risk? What kind of security organization do we need? What readiness, what preparedness do we need? What measures should we implement? And then you make the plan based on the analysis.
And because that checks all the three things of, you know, that sense of security that we have in ourselves. It's you're creating a sense of autonomy that they know what to do. You create a sense of certainty. They can go through the checklist, but then there's also a predictable outcome. If it's this incident, I have to do this, call this, and it just gets executed. There's not a lot of fumbling around. It's all about tangible things that I can implement. It's not about sort of deciding what I have to do and playing with all these scenarios in our head. It's just a clear cut scenario. And in crisis situation, I think that is so important. I mean, for example, if I was a company of, let's say, 50 people and we're working with some sort of, I don't know, technical industrial things, how long does it take on average to do a risk assessment, mapping the vulnerabilities and hazards and such? Can it differ from company to company?
Definitely. Depends on how complex it is and depends on how much they've done from before. We go in and assist people. And that's important to say. We don't make an analysis. People don't order an analysis and we make it and send it to them on email.
Okay.
That's not how it works. Because we know the mythology, but they know their business. So you have to combine the mythology with knowledge about the business. When you combine that, you know, the result is great because we map out how we're going to do the process and they fill in the information, you know, how many employees, what are the hazards, how many accidents have we had, what kind of machinery do we use, what kind of maintenance do we have, what kind of computer systems, like computer, what's it called? Hacking is
hacking. Yeah,
big threat to both public and private businesses. big time.
Cybersecurity is very important. I agree.
Cybersecurity is, it's maybe one of the biggest threats to a lot of companies these days. There was a municipality in the eastern part of Norway, Østre Toten.
Okay.
They were hacked. Basically, all employees had to sit down with pen and paper. And I think a couple of months or a year after, I read in the paper that they spent 35 million kroners to handle it. That was their loss. This was not a very big municipality either.
To do a risk assessment is not a cost. It's an investment. It's a security in how your people respond in a crisis situation, however that shows up. And it gives them a plan. Plus, in the end, if you have this and you try to, you can't mitigate all risk, but you mitigate a great proportion through, you know, a constructive response that you guys help map out with them because their expertise. Well, that sounds like an investment in resilience in a sense.
It is definitely. And because what we see, the results are that when something happens, they have gone through, you know, an unwanted incident. Mm. They will have gone through it. Can it happen? What should we do? And then they just implement the measures. And that's something different than not knowing anything. And because this is mandatory, it's required by law, it's very easy to say, yes, please, let's do this.
Well, Paul, I'm just respectful of your time. You know, I will include all your contact information because I'm sure there's a lot of people interested in your background to talk to you about that, but also in your consultancy. Just as a last question, is there something else, is there one or two things that you'd like to share as sense of wisdom or advice or sharing of knowledge for our listeners when it comes to resilience, whether it's their individual resilience or their organization's resilience?
I think that the most important thing I've learned is that building resilience is not something you do once. It's something you do all the time. And you have to evaluate, like a risk analysis. You make one. You don't put it in a drawer and finish. You have to evaluate. You have to renew. And it's an ongoing process. You don't build resilience once and then it's finished. You build it all the time. And the second thing is that I found really important is that resilience is built before, during, and after. You need all the three pieces. You need to be prepared. You need to know what can happen. Like the psychologist told us, stress turns out this way. You fight, flight, you freeze. This is the reaction from the people at home, blah, blah, blah. You know, they told us all these things. And then we found out later that it was, you know, spot on what they told us. And then you build a resilience during because you handle the situation however you handle it. And the more automated it is, the more extreme situation, the more it needs to be automated. And then you build resilience afterwards by diffusing, by debriefing, by going through, by talking to people. You know, talking to a friend. If you were in a house that started burning, if you were in a bad car accident, or if you saw somebody die or jump from a building or whatever it is, if you just lock it inside and don't talk to anyone, that's when the problems start. If you talk to someone, that's therapy. Mm. And that's the best way to build resilience and to avoid a bad aftermath.
Well, Paul, I really appreciate your time. I think it's been very interesting. I'm sure we could have pulled this over to 2 hours. But I'm just respectful of your time. And I find a lot of what you said resonates so much. I find so many parallels in what you do, which is completely different from what I've done. But there are so many parallels when it comes to our own sense of well-being, our own sense of resilience, whether you know, it's an individual, a civilian, a leader, a cop, a first responder, or an organization that you work for. So I really appreciate your time and sharing your knowledge and experience with us today.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Well,
go, folks. That was Paul Henriksen, COO of Einong Safety Consult, former soldier, former MP, police constable, and head of investigation. You know, if you are interested in mapping out your organization, your company, whether big or small, vulnerabilities, risks, or dangers, call Paul. You know, Paul's got deep experience and he's a really solid guy, and he will help you map out strategies and skills to build a more resilient organization. So in case that crisis ever happens, and hopefully it never does, but if it does, you will know how to react. And that, as I said earlier, can save life and limb. Anyways, Paul Henriksen, thank you for sharing your advice, your knowledge, and experience on today's episode. I really appreciate it. It was really great getting to know you and talking to you. Well, folks, this brings us to an end of another episode. I hope you learned a lot, and I hope it adds to your picture of resilience and of well-being. As usual, if you could please recommend, rate, and share this episode and the podcast with others, I would really appreciate it. And if you'd also like to subscribe to the weekly newsletter, you can find all that contact information in the show notes. Well, I wish you all a great week, and I will see you next Monday. But until then, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon.